Okay, let's get started. Afternoon session. The speaker will be Tom Goldstein, and in spite of the title, he's going to talk about improving reconstruction for MRIs. Right?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So should I? Truth be told, I am not actually a brain imaging person. I actually specialize in cardiac imaging, cardiac perfusion imaging. But the stuff I'm going to talk about today is not actually specific to any type of medical imaging other than MRI. So I'm going to start by talking about total variation-based methods in imaging. So I'm going to give a brief introduction to TV regularized optimization problems in L1. And then I'm going to talk about how we can apply this to compressed sensing, and we can use it to speed up MR imaging substantially. And then finally, I'm going to talk about some numerical methods for doing this and some results. So there's different frameworks in which we can do denoising. I think one of the more elegant methods that tends to produce good results is PDE-based imaging. So with PDE-based imaging, we first define two functionals. We have a noisy image F, and we want to reconstruct a denoised image U. So the first thing we do is we define a fidelity term that's usually called H. And H measures the difference between the reconstructed image and the noisy image. A common example of what we'd use for H is we would just take the 2 norm of the difference between the smooth image and the noisy image. Next, we need a regularization term, and we should call this J, and J measures the smoothness of the image. One common example of this is just take the 2 norm of the gradient of the image. And so if the image is smooth or denoised, you would expect that the gradient be relatively small, and so we're at small 2 norm. So to actually perform the denoising, we do an optimization problem where we make a trade-off between the smoothness term and the fidelity term, and usually have some regularization parameter that controls the balance between them. So if we use the L2-based denoising, it has several advantages, namely that it's easy to solve. You can just take the Euler-Lagrange equation for the PDE, and you get a simple linear elliptic equation that we can just solve using the Fourier transform method. And this is equivalent to using a low-pass filter. You just take the Fourier transform, you apply a Gaussian transfer function that eliminates most of the high-frequency modes, and then you take the inverse transform. And the problem with this is that if you eliminate a high-frequency mode, you have to eliminate it from the entire image. And as a result, this destroys all the high-frequency information, and it blurs all the edges in the image. But still, a lot of people use this because it's fast to compute. So the problem with L2 is that it's fast, but it penalizes all edges. It even penalizes the edges that we want to keep around. And so the solution is to scrap L2 and use the L1 norm instead. So we define a new fidelity term that is just the integral of the absolute value of the gradient instead of the integral of the square of the gradient. And then this gives us the famous Rudin-Oscher-Fatemi functional for denoising. And you'd think that changing L1 to L2 or L2 to L1 wouldn't make a huge difference, but it actually does. And when you use the ROF functional, you get a type of denoising that is very edge-preserving, and you can actually show that averaging in the image does not take place across edges. So it preserves discontinuities and it won't blur things. And the reason why this takes place is because L1 optimization problems give you signals that are sparse. So if you put the gradient of U inside of the L1 term and you combine it with an L2 fidelity term, the solutions you get are going to have grad U equal to 0 almost everywhere. So we're going to get things that are piecewise constant. And you can do this with all sorts of transforms. So for example, if you put the wavelet transform of U inside of the L1 term, you're going to get something where the wavelet transform of U is 0 almost everywhere. If you want to get something that's piecewise harmonic, you could stick the Hessian of U inside the L1 term. And you can also do deblurring problems this way, where you regularize by saying that the gradient of U should be sparse, and you put some sort of blurring kernel inside of the fidelity term. Here's a simple example of the type of results you can get. But if you take a piecewise constant image, so something where we'd expect that the gradient be relatively sparse, here's a noisy image, and then we denoise it using ROF, we denoise it using L2. You can see that if you denoise using L2, it still looks like there's a little bit of noise here because the noise hasn't really been eliminated. We just sort of smeared it around a little bit, and you destroy most of the edge information you have. But if you use ROF, you get a much crisper denoised image, and you get something that's very edge-preserving. So why is this example important for medical imaging? Well, one reason that's important is if you're going to do quantitative analysis on images, it's important that you have something that's very boundary preserving. And one example of where this is true that I work on is in perfusion imaging. You take contrast weighted images and you want to do some sort of quantitative analysis on them. So for contrast imaging, you have some sort of contrast region where the signal is much, much higher than in the area around it. So in this case, the region, this is a cross-section of the heart, you're looking down into the ventricles, and the contrast agent makes a very high signal intensity in the blood pool. In fact, the signal intensity in the blood pool is about 300 units. The signal intensity outside the blood pool is about 30 units. And so even if you use a denoising method that brings 10% of the signal from the blood pool into the tissue, you're going to double the signal inside of the tissue. So you need something that is very, very edge-preserving if you want to be able to do quantitative analysis on contrast-weighted images. So now we're going to change gears a little bit. We're going to talk about doing something a little bit different with LN optimization problems. We're going to do compressed sensing problems that we can use to speed up MR. But we're going to use the same sort of concept of LN sparsity. So first of all, why is it important to have fast acquisition times for MR imaging? There's a lot of reasons for this. I'm just going to mention a few of them. One of the big ones is pediatric imaging. Usually, if you want to scan a child for a long period of time, you have to sedate them because they tend to get restless, they get claustrophobic in the scanner, and they move around too much, and you get motion artifacts. So usually, you have to sedate a patient if you want to do any sort of scan that's going to have a long acquisition time. Also, for body cavity scans, the breath motion is a big problem. You have to have the patient hold their breath, and for elderly patients, that can be really difficult. Also, there are certain types of scans where you do multiple slices and it can take up to a minute to acquire, and most patients can't really hold the breath that long. Also, for the applications I work on, it's very important to have fast acquisition because in cardiac imaging, the heart is always beating, and this makes it very difficult. If you're going to image the heart, you have to do it when the heart's in the diastole, and that occurs for only a fraction of a second. Also, if it's easier to image animals in an experimental setting if you're doing cardiac imaging, because they have a fairly stable EKG, but humans can have a really unstable EKG, and it's hard to predict when the diastole is going to occur. And unless you have a very short acquisition time, it's hard to get a good image. And then finally, full body scans. If you're going to take a huge three-dimensional scan, it takes a long time, and you can't have the patient move. So what is it that determines how long it takes to scan an image? So in MR imaging, we don't actually observe an image directly. We put a patient in the scanner, and then the scanner gives us the K-space data, which is just the Fourier transform of the image that we're trying to acquire. So rather than observing the image itself, we observe the Fourier transform of the image, and it goes to a computer that takes the inverse Fourier transform, and then we have the image. So what determines how long it takes to acquire the image is how much of the K-space data do you want to acquire. And the time is roughly proportional to the amount of K-space data that you want to acquire, and it's not entirely a direct proportionality, because in reality what we usually do is we do a phase encode where we set the magnetic field gradient in the MRI to a specific setting, and you acquire one line of K-space, and then you do another phase encode, you acquire another line of K-space, and the real bottleneck is the number of phase encodes that you're going to do. So how do we usually speed things up? Well, conventional methods just rely on doing less phase encoding. So if you look at K-space data, if you make certain corrections, the K-space data turns out to be symmetric, and we can exploit that symmetry by only acquiring half of the K-space, and then before we do a reconstruction, we'll just use the symmetry, we'll flip the part we know over onto the part we don't, and then take the inverse Fourier transform. And this will allow us to cut the phase encodes in half. We can get our image about twice as quickly, but this also compromises the integrity of the image a lot. You lose resolution, and you get a much worse signal-to-noise ratio. And then there are also methods that are a little bit more clever about how they acquire K-space information. Like one example is keyhole imaging, where you pick and choose what part of K-space you want to acquire, and you try and sort of recycle information between images. So there's sort of a speed limit to how good we can get, and that's the Nyquist limit. The Nyquist principle says that if you want to resolve a particular Fourier mode in your image, you need to have enough data to sample it at least twice. And so what this tells us is that if you acquire less data, you're going to resolve less Fourier modes, and you're going to have lower resolution. And at the same time, less data means there's going to be less redundancy in your image, and so there's going to be a much lower signal-to-noise ratio. So the question of compressed sensing is there a way that we can reduce the amount of K-space data that we acquire, but at the same time, we don't want to lose resolution, and we don't want to lose signal-to-noise ratio? And so compressed sensing is motivated by some questions from image and signal processing. And the main concept is this. Suppose that you have a 10-megapixel camera, and you take a picture. That's going to give you about 10 megabytes of information. but then you save it on your computer and it only takes up about half a megabyte. So the question is, where did the information go? If you started with 10 megabytes of information, how did you end up with half a megabyte? And when you open the file and you load up the image, you get back a high resolution 10 megapixel representation of it. So how did we reconstruct it from so little information? And another question is, if we only need half a megabyte to represent the information, why do we need to collect 10 megabytes in the first place? Why do we have to take so much data if we only need very little data to reconstruct the image? And the answer is this. This works because images are redundant. Images tend to be smooth, and adjacent pixels tend to have similar values. And as a result of this, you can say this in a more mathematical way, images tend to be sparse in some transform. So for image compression, we usually use a block cosine transform like JPEG, or some of the newer image compression formats use wavelet transforms. You take a wavelet transform of your image, and then most of the wavelet coefficients are going to be zero or near zero, and so you can eliminate those, and you don't have to encode all of those coefficients, and that saves you a huge amount of space. Another transform that we often use in compressed sensing is we use the gradient transform. So you assume that the image lies in the space EV. You assume that the gradient of the image is sparse. And so if we assume that the images we're using are compressible, so if you assume that they're sparse in some basis, then we can exploit this information and do something like we do with image compression, where we use a very small amount of data to reconstruct a high-resolution image. And that's why it's called compressed sensing. So here's how we do a compressed sensing encoding. Suppose that we have some image U that we want to sense. We'll say that it's a vector in Rn, so it has n pixels. And using a conventional technique, you would have to take n elements out of k-space in order to reconstruct this image. So standard MRI says we're going to observe the vector y, where y is the Fourier transform of U. And then we'll reconstruct U by taking the inverse Fourier transform of y. Sparse MRI says we don't want to observe the entire k-space. We're just going to subsample a small set of it. So what we actually observe is R times the Fourier transform of U, where R is some downsampling operator. R is an M by N matrix, where M is substantially less than N. So it's a long rectangular matrix. And the question is, how small can we get M to be? So in theory, if there's not substantial noise, you can actually get M to be as small as N over log N. So if you have an N pixel image, you can reduce the amount of k-space you need by a factor of about 1 over log N. The question is, how do you choose R? If R is chosen properly, then Y is going to encode almost all the relevant information about you. But if R is chosen improperly, then this isn't going to work any better than doing, say, a half sample image acquisition. So how do we do the reconstruction? So we know that the data we sensed is equal to R, which is the restriction operator, times the Fourier transform of U. So if we try to go backwards and solve this, we find that there's a hyperplane of solutions. There's infinitely many solutions. So a solution could be of the form U is equal to, you could say, like the pseudo inverse of phi times Y. So you take some preimage for Y, and you add to it anything in the null space of R times F. So it seems like this is very, very non-unique. There should be no way of actually reconstructing U because of infinitely many solutions, but we have another piece of information. We know that U is going to be sparse in some transform. So in our case, we'll assume U lies in EV, or U is a sparse gradient. You can also do this by assuming it's a sparse in some wavelet transform. The idea is that if we choose R properly, then knowing this information will actually make this reconstruction unique. Even though there's actually a hyperplane of solutions, there's only one solution in the hyperplane that is actually sparse in the transform that we've chosen. And this will allow us to reconstruct you with very high resolution using very little k-space data. And in fact, you can show that if you know that U actually is indeed perfectly sparse in your transform, you can actually get exact reconstructions for U using a very small amount of information. So how do we choose R? And this is actually a pretty complicated topic, and I'm going to try and make it sound simple, but there's actually a very very rich and deep mathematical literature on this, and a lot of very good mathematicians have worked on this. But the idea is that to ensure unique reconstruction, you need to have something called the incoherent interference property. And what this means is that suppose we did a naive reconstruction for you. So suppose we just said, take all the Fourier modes that we don't know, because we haven't sampled them, set them equal to zero, and just take the inverse Fourier transform. If we do that, there's going to be a lot of errors in our images. And the idea is we want those errors to look like random noise, because random noise is going to cause the reconstructed image to not be sparse under the transform that we've chosen. And so by enforcing sparsity, it's possible to to choose the values of 40 modes that we don't know in the correct way. And the basic principle behind this is you want R to be sort of random in some sense. You want to randomly choose things out of the Fourier domain. You can make this very precise, and some very precise conditions were first proven in a paper by Candez, Romberg, and Tao. And later, these results were recast into a framework that you could use for MR imaging by David Donahoe at Stanford. So in order to make this work, we need to choose our subsampling operator in a very particular way. And the basic principle, like I said, is we want to sort of randomly sample k-space. And in reality, we can't just randomly sample because we'd have to do a lot of different phase codes, and that would be phase encodings, that would be expensive. So there's different ways you can do this. First, there's an easy strategy, which just says randomly select rows from k-space. So if we do this, we're just going to randomly choose phase encodings. Just do a whole bunch of them, but you only have to do, say, a third as many as you would do with conventional imaging, and then you do a reconstruction from that. But the problem is you're only exploiting sparsity in one dimension, because every phase code you're still acquiring an entire line of k-space. So here's a better strategy. Better strategy is use a spiral pulse sequence. With a spiral pulse sequence, you continuously vary the magnetic field gradient, and you acquire data, and you map out a spiral trajectory in k-space. Just to kind of show, I'm going to go on and talk about some numerical methods, just to sort of motivate this for now, to talk about some more results. Here's an example. So this is a real MR image. It's an image of a phantom. And what we did is we took a full k-space scan. We acquire the entire k-space, we do a conventional reconstruction, and we get this image here. Next thing we do is we subsample only 30% of k-space using some sort of randomized trajectory. And we do a conventional reconstruction using 30% of k-space, where we just fill the unknown coefficients with zeros. And you get something that has a lot of artifacts, makes the image look very hazy, has a very low signal-to-noise ratio. Then we do the compressed sensing reconstruction. And you can see that using only 30% of the k-space data, you can get something that looks almost identical to the original image, minus some of the noise, except that this image only took a third of the time to acquire that the image at the top did. So how do we actually do these reconstructions? We want to solve this problem. We want to find an image U that is consistent with the compressed sensing data we've observed. So we need, when we take the Fourier transform of our image and we downsample it, we need to get the vector Y that we've observed. And we want to find the vector that is sparse under the gradient transform. You take the gradient of U, you want it to be zero almost everywhere. So this is actually a combinatorial problem, and it's very difficult to solve. But fortunately, it turns out that we can sort of save ourselves using the L1 norm. And it's been shown that in certain situations, you can replace L0 with L1, and you still get the same results. So this goes back to what I said about ROF. If you take a transform and you stick it inside of the L1 norm, and you couple it with some L2 term, you get something that's sparse. And so we're going to exploit that to enforce that the transform of our image has to be sparse. And so we take this, and to make it easier numerically, we recast it as an unconstrained problem, where we want to minimize the BV norm of U, so it's just the L1 norm of the gradient of U, plus some penalty term. So we measure the 2 norm of the discrepancy between the Fourier transform of the image and the compressed sensing data that we observe. So ROF and compressed sensing problems look alike, and there's actually a lot of problems that look like this. The goal is that you want to minimize the BV norm of an image plus some fidelity term. So for TV denoising, we just look at the difference between the denoised image and the noisy image. For compressed sensing, we have to look at the Fourier transform of the image. But still, the problems are very similar. The general formulation is we want to minimize the BV norm of U plus some differentiable fidelity term, whatever it is. So L1 optimization problems have a lot of advantages. We can do these very high-resolution reconstructions of MR images, and you can get very edge-preserving denoising results, but they also have some disadvantages. And the disadvantages is that they're much more difficult to compute. If you take the Euler-Lagrange equation for the ROF functional, you get something that looks like this, where you have a fraction here that you're dividing by the gradient of U. But we know that in our results, the gradient of U is going to be zero almost everywhere. The gradient of U is going to be sparse. And so you'd think that you'd be dividing by zero a lot. And so if you want to do gradient descent on this problem, you have to regularize this denominator by adding some terms in to prevent it from being equal to zero, and even then you get something that's very nonlinear and very ill-conditioned. And it's very difficult to use gradient descent on this, and if you want to use a higher-order method like Newton time stepping, then you'd have to invert a Hessian that is very ill-conditioned. So what is it that makes these L1 problems difficult to solve? So let's take a look at some easy problems. First of all, if there's no L1 term at all, then it's easy. If it's just L2, it's a differentiable problem. You just take the derivative, set it equal to 0, solve it, you're done. Here's another easy problem. If you just want to minimize the L1 norm of u with no gradient inside of here, plus this fidelity term, then it's a separable problem. You can just solve it element-wise, and that's an easy problem. But if you look at some hard problems, the hard problems are the problems where there's coupling between the L1 and the L2 term. So if I put some linear transform phi in front of u in the L1 term, it becomes difficult to solve. If you put some transform in front of u in the L2 term, it also becomes difficult to solve. So our goal is going to be to eliminate this coupling. So we take the general L1 regularized optimization problem, and we want to split the L1 and the L2 terms to eliminate this coupling. So we'll make a substitution. So we'll define a new variable d, and we'll say that we want d to be equal to phi of u. So this gives us a new constrained problem. Now we want to minimize the L1 norm of d plus the fidelity term, and we have constraint, d is equal to phi of u. So in order to solve this constrained problem, we'll go back and do a more conventional method, and we'll make it an unconstrained problem. Instead of saying d has to be equal to phi of u, we'll add an L2 penalty term. We'll say that d minus phi of u has to be small. And we'll put some parameter in front of here to control how small it has to be. So this is a splitting method that was independently introduced by a group at Rice. And the way that they do this is they modify the problem, they solve this optimization problem for a value of lambda, and then they increase lambda. And the higher lambda goes, the more strictly you'll enforce this equality until you have a solution to the equality constraint problem. But this has some problems within a particular, the condition number of this problem gets very bad as you increase lambda. And so we take a different approach. So what we do is we group the first two terms together, we just call them E. And now we define a Bregman distance associated with this convex functional. And so some of you are familiar with some of the literature on ROF denoising, Bregman iteration is used to improve ROF denoising, and it's used in a lot of other applications in imaging. Some of you might already be familiar with this. If you're not familiar with it, then just hold on for a few slides, and we'll kind of simplify things in a minute. So rather than solve the original problem, we'll replace E with its Bregman distance, and we're going to iteratively solve this problem. Minimize a problem involving the Bregman distance, and then you update the variables uk and dk, and you solve a new problem involving the Bregman distance. So because of the convexity of the functionals that we're using, we can prove some things about this iteration. We can prove that d minus phi of u approaches 0 as the number of iterations approaches infinity. And you can also show that u and d approach some limiting values, and that these limiting values that they approach satisfy the original constrained optimization problem that we were trying to solve. And it therefore follows that the solution we have solves the original optimization problem that we were trying to solve before we split it. So fortunately, this isn't as complicated as it looks, because we can simplify the Bregman iteration. We can move some terms back inside of this L2 term, and what we end up with is a problem that looks like the original split problem. We want to minimize the L1 norm of d, and we want d to be equal to the sparsity transform of u, plus the fidelity term, plus this penalty term here. And this penalty term enforces that d has to be equal to phi of u. But instead of letting lambda get large, what we do is we stick a vector b inside of this L2 term. And the idea is that by choosing b properly, by choosing this to have a proper value, we can enforce that d equal to b equal to phi of u without actually changing the value of lambda. And this allows us to solve a set of very well-conditioned problems. So we solve this optimization problem, and then we update the value of b, and you iteratively solve the problem and update the value of b until you eventually get to something that solves the original problem. So just a quick summary of what we did. We started with some L1 constrained problem. So you say L1 norm of phi of u plus some fidelity term. We form the split formulation, so we substitute d into the L1 term, and then to enforce that d be the same as phi of u, we add on this penalty term, and you stick the Bregman parameter b in here in order to enforce the constraint exactly. And then we iteratively solve this problem. So you minimize this functional with respect to d and u, and you update the value of b. So why is this better? We started with a simple L1 optimization problem. We made it into a constrained optimization problem, and then we made it back into an unconstrained optimization problem. And now we have two variables instead of one variable, and we have this Bregman update. Why is this better? And the answer is that you can break the minimization down into three steps that are easy to compute. So the first step is minimize this energy with respect to you. And this is fairly straightforward because H of you is differentiable. And this L2 term is also differentiable. So to minimize with respect to you, you just take an Euler-Lagrange equation, set it equal to zero, and solve it. To minimize with respect to D, now the problem is decoupled with respect to the elements of D, and so we can just go through and solve this element-wise. And so we have a direct solver for the problem with respect to D. And then the Bregman update is a simple explicit update that's relatively fast to compute. Normally, when we do the minimization with respect to U, because of the transforms that we'll choose, we can solve this very efficiently using a Fourier transform or some other fast iterative method. So an example of how to do this, let's say we want to solve the ROF problem. So we use anisotropic ROF, which means we treat the derivative in the x and the y direction separately. So you want to enforce that the x derivative and the y derivative of U be sparse, but that your denoised image U looks like your noisy image F. So what we do is we split this up. First, we substitute a variable in here and a variable in here to decouple it. So now dx and dy instead of grad x and grad y. And then to enforce that dx and dy look like the gradients they correspond to, you add these penalty terms on here. And then you stick a Bregman parameter inside the L2 term to enforce the equality. And then the algorithm breaks down into five steps that are very fast to compute. So the first one is minimize with respect to U. And that, it turns out to, the Euler-Lagrange equation for you turns out to be a diagonally dominant equation. And so you can solve it very efficiently using a Gauss-Seidel iteration. Then you minimize with respect to the auxiliary variables D, and that's just a simple, you solve it element-wise using a thresholding operation. And then you update the Bregman parameters. And so this entire cycle is very cheap. The Gauss-Seidel iteration is just an averaging of all the pixels and surrounding.
Got an x and a y and step 4 and 5 should be something.
Oh yeah, so this should be d sub x and this should be d sub y. Sorry about that. So you do a Gauss-Seidel iteration with just a few additions and a multiplication. And then the shrinkage, just a few, two Boolean ifs and then addition, I think. And then this is two additions and a subtraction per pixel. So the whole cycle is just a few operations per pixel. And this ends up being very fast. You can also do the isotropic TV functional by combining d sub x and d sub y together under square root. And in that case, you have to use a more, it doesn't quite decouple element-wise, but you can use a more sophisticated thresholding operator that was introduced by Wotalian at Rice University. And we can still get very fast performance with an isotropic problem, which is significant because many of the fastest methods for solving these types of problems are graph cut methods that can only do anisotropic cases. So we do some time trials for ROF. And for 512 by 512 image, you can solve it a little over a quarter of a second. And it's somewhat slower for the isotropic, about half a second for 512 by 512. But these are comparable to some of the fastest methods for ROF, like the graph cut methods, but now you have the advantage that you can solve the isotropic problem. And we can actually speed this up even more if we are willing to go partway to convergence. So because the Gauss-Seidel iteration smooths things out very fast, for denoising purposes, the Gauss-Seidel iteration kills the noise very quickly. But the Bregman iteration is very edge-preserving. So even before we reach convergence, you still have very sharp edges. So here's a problem with the square test image. And you can see we start with a noisy image, and these are the cross-sections of the image here. So the cross-section looks very noisy at the beginning. If we just do 10 Gauss-Seidel passes, you'll see that we get a very good representation of the denoised image. And if you go to convergence, which takes 50 iterations, you get something that looks almost identical to what you had at 10 iterations. So one of the nice things about this method is that if you stop early or you use a fairly loose convergence criteria, then you still end up with pretty good results. So this is just saying what I just said. You can, if you're willing to accept a sort of an eyeball norm convergence criteria, you can speed things up a lot. You can do about 54 milliseconds for the 512 by 512 image. And then these are just some examples applied to a test image. I realize this is a medical image, but we'll get to some medical images in a minute. But you can see that you start with your original image, the noisy image, and then 10 iterations and 50 iterations. And in the eyeball norm, they're very similar. So you can solve this problem very quickly. And you notice because we use an L1 minimization, you don't, even though we're denoising here, we don't blur at all. You still get very sharp edges. Okay, so how can we apply this framework to solve compressed sensing problems? So many people find that they get better results in their compressed sensing if they use two sparsity transforms. They use both the gradient transform and they use the wavelet transform. So we have this optimization problem that says we want to be sparse We want the gradient of our image to be sparse. We want the wavelet transform of our image to be sparse. But we also want our image to be consistent with the Fourier data that we've observed. It has to be consistent with the k-space data that we know. So we apply split gradient to this. So we say take gradient of u and substitute in a variable d to represent it. We'll take the wavelet transform of u. We'll call this guy little w. And then you form the split gradient formulation. So you take something that looks like the original optimization problem, but now instead of the sparsity transforms, we have these auxiliary variables. And then to enforce that the auxiliary variables are equal to the sparsity transforms, you add these penalty terms on there. And then this gives you a very efficient algorithm. What we do is we first minimize with respect to u, and it turns out that even though we're using a hybrid of derivatives and wavelet transforms, the Euler-Lagrange equation for the minimization we have to solve turns out to be circulant. So we can solve this using two FFTs. So you minimize with respect to u, which costs two FFTs, and then you do a shrinkage operation, which is just a few additions, and then you update the Bregman parameters, which just requires a wavelet transform and a few additions. So this entire cycle is very efficient. The most expensive part is the two FFTs. So in order to enforce that that we are consistent with the k-space data, we want to have some condition that says, for example, the difference between the Fourier transform of the image recovered and the original k-space data is less than sigma, where sigma is some noise parameter. Or if you don't want to do any denoising, you can set sigma to be very, very small. And so we do sort of a double Bregman scheme where we solve an optimization problem, and then you update the value of this f here using some update rule. And by doing that, you can enforce that the image that you reconstruct is perfectly consistent with the k-space data that you observe. So here's some examples of actual compressed sensing reconstructions. So here's an exact reconstruction where you only use a quarter of the k-space data. And this is a simulated example, and so it's kind of an easy test case because the image is actually completely sparse in the transform. It's piecewise constant. So here's the original image. Here is an image reconstructed from 25% of the k-space. So you take an image, we say, okay, we don't know all the Fourier modes, you only know a quarter of them. Just fill in the ones we don't know as zeros and take the inverse Fourier transform and see what we get. And you get something very noisy. This is supposed to be 25% k-space reconstructed with nearest neighbor interpolation, but it doesn't really come out very well on the monitor. But so you're going to have to kind of take my word for it. But it looks very washed out. So the purpose of this example is to show that compressed sensing really is better than interpolation. You're not just making guesses as to what the missing Fourier modes are. You're actually using a very specific mathematical criterion to figure out what they would have to be in order for the image to satisfy certain properties. So then here's the compressed sensing reconstruction. And in this case, you get an exact correspondence between the original and the compressed sensing reconstruction, even though we only use a quarter of the k-space data. And so here's our phantom image again. This is showing the progression of this split Bregman algorithm. So we start with the original full k-space image. Then we take a scan where we just get 30% of the k-space information. So we acquire this image three times as fast as we acquire this one. And this is using a method where we just pad the image with zeros to fill in the unknown coefficients. And you get a lot of noise artifacts and a lot of haze. So then we start doing the split Bregman algorithm. And as the iterations of the algorithm proceed, you'll see that we start to get back fine scale information. You start to get back edges and small scale features. So the first thing that comes back are these large-scale features here. And then at 10 iterations, at 20 iterations, you'll see the haze is starting to kind of move away. Smaller-scale features are starting to come out. And then finally, 30 iterations. And at 40 iterations, you get back all of the small-scale features that you had in the original image. So you're getting back a very high-resolution image that resolves a lot of small-scale information, but you only use 30% of the k-space to do it. So you could acquire this image here three times as fast as you acquire this image. And then finally, here's a brain example. I thought this is brain imaging conference, so I should show a brain example. This is not as good of an example because here we didn't do the spiral subsampling. Here what we do is we do a simpler type of pulse sequence where we randomly sample lines from k-space by randomly doing phase encodes. And so this is the simpler way to do compressed sensing, but the results are not quite as effective. So here's the full k-space image. And then here's a reconstruction that uses a nearest neighbor interpolation to fill in the missing k-space modes, and then does the Fourier transform. And then here's the compressed sensing reconstruction. And so you'll see you do much better with the compressed sensing reconstruction, And so even though this image is acquired twice as fast as this one, you still get reasonably close to what the image would have been with the full k-space information. And you can do, and if we had done a spiral pulse sequence here, we would have done even better. To wrap it up, you can potentially speed up your image acquisitions by a factor. Well, it depends on how you do it, but most people would say you can get, say, a 3 to 5 times acceleration by using a compressed sensing acquisition. And if you're doing three-dimensional imaging, you could do substantially better than that. And we have this, with the Slip-Bregman algorithm, you can get very good fine-scale features out of your reconstruction because it's very edge-preserving. And a few other advantages of this approach is that it has a relatively small memory footprint. And the method is easy to parallelize. So if you want to take, say, a 60-slice scan and reconstruct it very quickly, you can parallelize it, you can put on a GPU, and these can be computed very fast. And then finally, it's fairly easy to code. And I just want to say I work in collaboration with some people at the Mellencrantz Institute at Washington University, and they helped me out with getting a lot of my medical images. That's it. The question is, what sort of assumptions do you want to make on your image before you do the reconstruction? And that's actually kind of a complicated issue because it goes back to this incoherence idea. You assume that your image is sparse under some transform. And so you think that if you choose some sort of clever transform that takes account the structure of your image, maybe you can do a lot better. But the thing you have to keep in mind when designing the transform is that it has to be incoherent. It has to have this pointwise incoherence property. If you do this naive reconstruction where you just fill in a bunch of zeros and take the inverse Fourier transform, you need the noise to be decorrelated. And that's the most important property. So you're, in some sense, you're kind of limited by that. And it may be possible to do better with a smarter sparsity transform. There aren't a lot of theoretical results on that because most of the theoretical results assume that your sparsity transform satisfies certain conditions, or that if you're orthogonal or invertible or some other criteria. So I guess the answer to the question is maybe, but there's not really a lot of literature on that.
Okay, back there.
Yep. So in fMRI, you don't have intensity contrast edges where you ultimately need them, which is at the edges of activation. Is this method appropriate for that kind of imaging? Mm-hmm.
So with the TV regularization, you'd be assuming, it seems like you're implicitly assuming that the image is piecewise constant, but actually that doesn't, even when the image isn't piecewise constant, this technique is still relatively effective. This is definitely not piecewise constant. If you look at this image here, you'll see because of this was taken with a surface coil, and so because of the sensitivity profile of the coil, the image is brighter over here than it is over here. So this image is actually not piecewise constant. There's a pretty strong gradient across the image. And so even when you have gradients in your image or things that aren't very well-defined edges, you still actually get pretty good reconstructions out of it. In fact, a lot of what you're exploiting in MR imaging is just the black space. There's a lot of noise in the black space that you don't actually have to encode. So most medical images are pretty sparse under some transform, even if they don't appear to be piecewise constant. Also, if you use some sort of wavelet transform, you can relax this piecewise constant assumption and allow the image to have some curves and gradients while still being sparse in the transform.
But the signal is often, for any given single EPI image in fMRI, the signal is often completely lost in the noise, and it's not until you do the final time series analysis that you get the signal. So is this going to work in that situation?
I don't really know enough about functional MR to really say for sure, but it's generally pretty robust to noise. And there's some compressed sensing results that people have done where they take pretty noisy data, and you still get back pretty good reconstructions. But obviously that has its limits. If your image is noisy enough and there's not enough information there, it probably wouldn't work. But in a worst case scenario, you'd expect that the compressed sensing reconstruction be no worse than a conventional reconstruction. So in a worst case scenario, the assumptions don't quite hold and you don't really gain anything. But it shouldn't really be worse than what you would have had if you didn't do compressed sensing, because either way, the image you're reconstructing is still compatible with the case-based information.
I guess you said something in that direction already, but I just want to make sure that I understand correctly. I thought that the original results of Candace and those guys on this problem required that the sparsity of this thing would be really very, very strong for the RIP property to really hold and all that, sort of a theoretical foundation. And I would be surprised if real-world medical images were that sparse, because the limits in their theories are very strong. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you could comment.
So there's different ways to look at compressed sensing. First, there's like the Candace-Romberg-Tal approach, where you're just using L1 of U as a regularizer, and you assume that your measure matrix phi has to satisfy RIP or some other more general condition. And some of the theoretical results on that assume that K is very that the image is actually very sparse in the transform. But there are also theoretical results that just assume that your image is small, and it's called a weak LP norm, which means you take the transform of your image and you order all the coefficients, and you should have some sort of rapid decay of those coefficients, but they don't actually have to be zero, so it doesn't actually have to truly be sparse. And you can prove that in that case, if your image is nearly sparse in a very precise sense, you'll still get something very near to the original image, even with the compressed sensing data. So you don't actually quite have to assume sparsity. Some of the stronger theoretical results do, just because it makes it easier to prove stuff, but you don't actually have to assume that. And if you look at images, usually you do have that decay. That's why, say, JPEGs are so compressible. You take away the transform of an image and you get, it's very small and this speak up, you normally get really fast decay.
Can you use the method and also get out what the sparse basis is? Get a sparse basis?
To recover the sparse, I'm not too sure what you mean.
Well, you.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You want to figure out which of the non-zero elements of the transform.
Yes, and maybe more important, which of the zero elements.
Yeah. Well, you sort of, by doing the reconstruction, you sort of implicitly have that though. So you get the reconstructed image. Just take the transform and see which ones are zero. Actually, when you do split Bregman, you sort of get that implicitly, because you're sort of implicitly deciding which ones are non-zero. So we replace, say, the wavelet transform of U with this element W here. So W represents the wavelet transform of the image. And so as time goes on, the thresholding operator we use is going to keep most of the elements of W zero, but as the algorithm proceeds, some of those are going to grow out and break away from zero and increase. And so that the sparse basis is actually sort of encoded in W. Elements that are non-zero are non-zero on W, I guess. You can actually look at what the sparse basis is. Is that what you're asking?
Yes. Okay.
Actually, I have two questions. One is the experience in the past. So if you do this type of generation of new images and then show it to radiologists, they are sometimes quite reluctant to accept the new type of images, especially if you talk about somehow piecewise smooth. So I was just curious if you have any experience in would they accept this type of imaging.
So
second question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Doctors really hate processed images, and I think part of that is some people don't really understand how much processing goes into the images before they see them. People say, I don't want to see any image processing. I just want to see the data that comes out of the machine, and they don't realize that the data that comes out of the machine is not interpretable by a human being in any sense. But it's usually hard to sell people on something that changes the image in any way. So doctors hate denoising, because they're worried that there'll be some feature in the image that might be destroyed by denoising. And I think they're absolutely right. You don't want to denoise medical images, because I don't think that you're going to reveal anything that the doctors already can't see. But there's a difference between compressed sensing and denoising. And the difference is that the image you reconstruct is perfectly compatible with the case-based information that you've observed. So either way, whether you can sell doctors on this is questionable to guess. But no matter how you reconstruct an image, you have to make an assumption. Then normally the assumption you make is you assume that your image is has a finite spectral radius. So you assume that you only have a finite number of Fourier modes. And that actually causes a certain amount of image distortion because it's gonna blur out high frequency components. So for compressed sensing, we say that's no longer assumed that. It's no longer assumed bandwidthiness. And instead, we're going to assume that it's sparse in some transform. So, but the images, either way, you have to make an assumption. And either way, the images you get are perfectly consistent with the k-space data that you observe. So I think that there's no reason to think that this should destroy any features of the image that would be useful in a clinical setting. If anything, it would reveal some high-frequency information that you can't resolve with conventional reconstruction. But yeah, whether doctors are gonna want to use that, I don't know. But what I'm saying is this is definitely better than denoising in that sense. You never lose information. With compressed sensing, you're only going to gain information.
I don't want to take too much.
Okay. Feel free.
No.
Yes, back there. Question? No. I have a comment. Why does this work so fast? And the answer is, as we know, because of L1. So Bregman iteration is something that's been around since 1967. Bregman's alive and well and living in Israel. Doesn't know we're doing this, I think. The reason it works is it's something special about L1 because of the kink in the norm. If you try this with L2 memorization, it won't do anything special. Right? That's it. Comment.